You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 17th of September 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, the recovery will be green. The EU Commission's president promises that the clawback from COVID will bring lasting changes to the environment too. But how much is Ursula von der Leyen placing the member states on an internal collision course? Plus, we get the latest from our US election correspondent on how wildfires are affecting the candidates' campaigns.
For those people who have been directly impacted by the devastating wildfires, the proportion of which haven't been seen in a generation or so, they will look to something more detailed to try and rectify the problem.
Also ahead, Hong Kong asked the US to drop rules forcing its exports to be labelled made in China. We'll examine a battle over names and principles. Plus, BA's boss sounds a desperate call about the state of his airline and the world of aviation. We'll ask if anyone can or will step in to help. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. Before we get started, a look at what else is happening in today's news. New Zealand has gone into its deepest recession in decades following lockdown measures introduced to cut the spread of COVID-19. The US Democratic candidate Joe Biden has warned against peace in Northern Ireland from becoming a casualty of Brexit. And the home of the US civil rights figure Rosa Parks has been put on display in Naples in Italy. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, people want to move out of this corona world, out of this fragility, out of uncertainty. They're ready for change and they're ready to move on. Ursula von der Leyen's tweet ahead of her first State of the Union address was full of vim, vigour and dynamism. Her focus is one of recovery being achieved through making the EU carbon neutral. She said the EU should set a target to cut greenhouse gas emissions by at least 55% by 2030. That's up from a current target of 40%. But how much will all 27 member states agree with her? Well, to tell us more, I'm joined on the line from Brussels by Kalina Oroshakov, who's the international climate politics reporter for Politico. A very warm welcome to the programme, Kalina. Good to have you.
Thank you very much. Good morning from Brussels.
This was a hugely important first speech for Ursula von der Leyen, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. I mean, first of all, as you said, it's her first one. And then secondly, of course, it comes at a time when pretty much everything has changed. I think COVID pretty much overthrew all of the original plans she had and her commission had, which is also why it's been so interesting to see how she would frame some of the main policy priorities in her speech yesterday.
And the way she framed them was very much from an environmental perspective, wasn't it?
Exactly. I think one of the interesting aspects of yesterday's speech was that she very much emphasized the green course that the European Commission wants the EU to go. You may know in December she had announced her flagship program of the European Green Deal that's meant to make the EU climate neutral, so slashing greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2050. And she very much, again, doubled down on that message yesterday, saying that pursuing that cause and even strengthening efforts to cut emissions will very much help the EU's attempts to come out of the pandemic's economic fallout, as well as become more, and that's a new EU word, more resilient to weather future crises.
How does she intend to fuse the two ideas, namely of recovery from COVID economically and to ensure that the European Union is carbon neutral by 2050?
Well, the message that she and her commission pursue, and very many other players as well, I mean, essentially, is that it doesn't cost the economy to do more on the environment and to do more to slash emissions, but actually it will help and promote economic growth and jobs. And so that's very much how both these programs are being married. And I think initially, and with COVID starting, the pandemic really having an economic effect, there was quite a lot of concern that it would undermine the EU's green agenda. But rather to the contrary, I think there's become a growing realization that going green is going to be good for the economy. And that's very much also the message Ursula von der Leyen pushed yesterday. And then on the other hand, I think it's also become much more evident that climate change impacts will hurt you economically. I mean, yesterday she gave a number of speeches. We see glaciers melting. There are more and more destructive droughts across Europe, and more people feel the impacts. And I think that comes with a cost. And so there's more of a awakening to the fact that that climate change has an economic impact, not just an potentially social or environmental one.
And she called not just for the, you know, the general, the infrastructure questions to be addressed, but she called for what she described as a new European Bauhaus, as what's been described as a co-creation platform for architects, engineers and designers to launch an architectural style of our times. And this is something that suggests that she's digging deep into people's lifestyles as well.
Indeed. I think that's one of the very interesting questions now in climate policy is now that you really have to speed up emission cuts, now that you really have to speed up action because impacts are becoming ever more evident. And there is this more real question of how does it affect our lives, including how does it affect the way we live. And I think it was interesting for her to especially look into the question of buildings and urban environments, because it's become an area that many climate campaigners and experts are much more focusing on, especially with most people living in cities, for example, with populations expected to move towards the cities ever more in the future, and with cities being the most exposed to many climate impacts. I think it's an interesting topic for her to raise. And then, of course, as a German, I think the Bauhaus mention was a nice national touch.
It was indeed. But let's move on to the issue to national issues. I mean, Germany's reputation on climate is not perhaps what it could be. And there are several of the 27 member states who will object strongly to any great push against making their countries greener, such as their dependence on fossil fuels.
Yes, indeed. I think now it's going to be interesting to see how member states will react to the proposal. Yesterday, we already saw quite a lot of countries react on Twitter. And many of the greener countries from Northern Europe and Western Europe, be that the Netherlands or Luxembourg, Sweden, Finland, all of them have already for a long time been pushing for a 55% goal. So they expectedly came out rallying around that proposal from von der Leyen. On the other hand, as you say, we have poorer, more coal-reliant countries in Central Europe, as well as member states like Germany, who have been in the past wary of increasing the targets. I think the big issue will, of course, be money, which is always the big issue in EU negotiations, as well as the concrete plans and supporting measures that Brussels intends to roll out to help countries speed up emission cuts. So I think that's very much the big debate that we were looking forward to see unfold.
Looking forward to, but with, you know, everybody's climate change issues at possibly at the absolute heart of this. But I mean, is there any sense that she will be pushed back against with all this? I mean, it's funny, when she first took up the presidency, people were saying that her climate change ambitions were not high enough. And yet she still ends up sort of being pushed back by the likes of Poland, who say, no, come on, we actually don't have the infrastructure to afford this, nor do we wish to.
Yes, I mean, definitely pushback, definitely. And you already mentioned Poland, which reacted yesterday very much on that message to say, we want to hear how you plan on helping us. So I think in that sense, it's less that the rhetoric has shifted a little bit on from we don't want to become greener, but more show us what we can do and show us the help you intend to give us before we say anything. So I think that's a slight change. But there will, of course, be lots of pushback also once countries realize what it will really mean for their strategic sectors. You mentioned Germany. Germany has always been a tricky one because of its auto sector. I think any concrete proposals that would increase the efforts on behalf of the auto sector will trigger political reactions. I think any of the proposals that will show that industry will have to pay higher prices for being allowed to emit under the EU's carbon market will trigger pushback. So it's going to be very tough. I mean, if you think about the 40% cut that you mentioned, that is the current EU climate target, was only agreed 6 years ago, and it was a massive issue. And 6 years later, we're talking about 55%. That wasn't even a possible target just a couple of years ago. So it's going to be a huge fight. But I do believe that things have politically changed in the sense that because climate impacts have become a reality also in Europe, because voters can feel it too, political calculations change. And then, of course, the technology has shifted. Renewables have become cheaper. Alternative energy technologies have become cheaper and more available. So you have a shifting environment that might just end up playing in von der Leyen's favour.
There are technologies which are becoming cheaper. Nonetheless, industries will have to pay for this. You know, transport will have to pay for it. Heavy industry will have to pay for it. And you mentioned the fact that businesses will have to face higher carbon costs. Where is this money going to come from when at the moment there is no money because of COVID?
I think that's a big question. That's a circle that needs to be squared. I mean, on the one hand, you have the EU's massive recovery and program, a number of funds that have been proposed and have been agreed by EU leaders that are supposed to help countries come out of the crisis. And the Commission very much is trying to push to make sure that these national recovery programs that are using EU funds will very much go towards the EU's green goals. So I think that's the attempt to square that financial circle. On the other hand, of course, there are going to be attempts to come up with alternative funding models to try to more closely involve the European Investment Bank, to more incentivize financial programs also from the private sector that can fund all of those green programs. And then, of course, you have the private sector with many players and especially lots of investors having pushed the Commission to go for a more ambitious goal because they say that will give them the certainty and the predictability to invest in greener projects. So there's hope that all of those different elements will fall into place.
Kalina Oroshkova, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. Now, a moment ago, we heard about the EU's green new plans. Let's turn our attention to the United States to hear from our US elections correspondent, Thomas Lewis. With wildfires raging all along the West Coast, climate change has now taken centre stage ahead of November's election, at least for some, as Thomas now explains.
Well, Joe Biden has garnered quite a lot of praise for his climate policy proposals as part of his bid for the White House. Many have described it as the Green New Deal in all but name. It's interesting that Joe Biden has endorsed many of the tenets of the Green New Deal. That was, of course, a landmark policy, set of policy proposals by some progressive Democratic senators on Capitol Hill. I wonder whether his not wanting to endorse it in name is to stave off these attacks by some Republicans and by the president himself, that any kind of economic green plan, if you like, any green economy, building back better, as Joe Biden's slogan for his presidential run has it, is really another marker of Democratic government run wild, that it would be a huge overstretch of what the government should do and the role it should play in the American economy and in American society as well. Just given the scale, however, of the fires currently tearing through large stretches of the Western US, it really is something that is gaining a lot more attention now in terms of the policy platform of each candidate. And for Donald Trump, I think it might be another area where he might struggle. Perhaps some of his hardcore voters believe him when he says that climate change is made up, that science doesn't really know what climate change is. But for those people who have been directly impacted by the devastating wildfires, the proportion of which haven't been seen in a generation or so, they will look to something more detailed to try and rectify the problem. And if that's what you are looking for, then it's clear that you would be finding much more detail in Joe Biden's plan on a green energy future for the United States than in Donald Trump's.
Thomas Lewis there. You're listening to The Globalist. What's in a name or indeed in a label? Well, if you are in Hong Kong and you are an exporter, then you may feel as if you've been plunged into an argument over independence and identity. Hong Kong has formally written to Washington, demanding it drop new rules which force products made in Hong Kong and exported to the US to carry the label Made in China. Well, I'm joined on the line by Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief, James Chambers. Welcome back, James.
Morning.
What's happened?
Well, as we all might recall, last month, amongst a flurry of things coming out of the Trump White House concerning Hong Kong, in response to the national security bill in Hong Kong, they brought in this new rule that requires, you know, people who exporters who make products in Hong Kong and export to the US to change the labeling. So it no longer say made in Hong Kong, it will have to say made in China. This rule was meant to come in next week, but it's been delayed until November. And yesterday, the Commerce Secretary in Hong Kong, Edward Yao, sent a letter to the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, basically demanding that this rule was changed or revoked. And he's been making gone through straight to Robert Lighthizer, but also through the WTO in Geneva. If that fails, and everyone expects this letter to be more of a show of face than anything that'll actually bring about change, then these rules will come into place in November, and Hong Kong companies who do manufacture here will have to change their labeling on goods that are exported to the US, not around the world. But as you can imagine, changing that one label for one export jurisdiction adds a cost. And so companies that rely on the US market might then be forced to take the decision to change all of their labeling to made in China. And then basically you lose that kind of the made in Hong Kong stamp.
And therefore you also lose your export identity as well. And Hong Kong is unhappy enough about this to decide that it could take the matter to the World Trade Organization.
Yes, that's what Edward Yao was saying in the press and in his letter. So, I mean, everyone's wondering why it took a month for the Hong Kong government to actually object formally to this move. And they are saying that their next step could be to take the US to the WTO. Apparently, the Hong Kong government has a game plan. But I guess this comes on the back of the WTO's ruling that found the US had violated the WTO rules when it brought in those tariffs against China in 2018. And as it's become clear, that ruling will have zero impact in practice because Donald Trump has effectively neutered the WTO and there's nothing they can do in a situation like this. So I think that threat of taking the US to the WTO is a bit of a red herring. And as with a lot of these things, this battle between US and China, I mean it's being fought in the media, but when you kind of look at the underlying situation, this isn't going to have a great deal of impact in Hong Kong. Last year, some 471 million US dollars worth of made in Hong Kong products were exported to the US. That might sound like a big number, and it certainly will be a big deal for the companies that do make their stuff in Hong Kong and export to the US. But it is some 0.1% of the total number of exports from Hong Kong, and the vast majority of goods that pass through Hong Kong are so-called re-exported goods. So they're goods that come in from somewhere and get sent on to other places. At the end of the day, Hong Kong is a hub. It's a trade and logistics hub that shifts stuff around. It doesn't make that much stuff. So this is very much a symbolic argument. Hong Kong's objected to it, but there could be a potential workaround in the mix. There has been a suggestion that they could start labeling things made in Hong Kong, China. So we'll see how this one gets resolved.
Financial benefits or otherwise notwithstanding, this is more, in many ways, a symbolic argument, isn't it? Because if you are Hong Kong and you take the matter to the World Trade Organization, you play as an independent state, which obviously puts you right against the idea that Hong Kong is moving more and more and more to alignment with the Chinese mainland. So it's stuck, isn't it? Because either it pushes for its own identity or it looks disloyal to Beijing.
Well, Hong Kong is a member of the WTO in its own right. And both the Hong Kong government and the Beijing government keep maintaining that this one country, two systems arrangement is still in place, and they very much stand behind it. Now we're in this bizarre situation where you have Hong Kong and to an extent, you know, the mainland government, because they will have been doing all of these moves in tandem, arguing that Hong Kong is indeed a separate customs territory. And then you have the US, which is arguing the opposite and saying that Hong Kong is just another Chinese city and should be treated as that. So, you know, the US brought in these measures to essentially punish China for bringing in its national security bill. But the effect of what Trump is doing is to, you know, basically destroy all the vestiges of Hong Kong's, you know, independence. So it has always been a funny move from Washington to basically punish Hong Kong, Hong Kong businesses, Hong Kong people for what Beijing has done. But, you know, as we've seen in a lot of things, the war between the US and Beijing is being fought in these kind of proxy places at the moment, whether that's Hong Kong or WTO. And sadly, you know, Hong Kong is being punished. But there are, you know, there are moves that will worry Hong Kong a lot more than this made in China label. I mean, we just had that that change the other day that came out of the U.S. State Department, which you know, issued a travel advisory warning for U.S. citizens not to, or to think twice about traveling to Hong Kong, because you might get, you know, arrested for what you say or what you do under the security bill. Well, that's a, you know, that's a potentially huge move, and potentially devastating one for Hong Kong, because, you know, the tourism industry here relies a lot on American visitors. You know, they're one of the most high spending nationality to come to Hong Kong, and if they are put off from visiting, that will be cause a lot of damage. So you know, this made in China one is definitely, as you said, it's a very symbolic one, but obviously when you package it all together with everything that's going on, you know, Hong Kong will end up hurting, and it will lose out.
James, thank you. Still to come on today's programme, we're off to St Moritz to hear from the Monocle Conference happening today, the Chiefs, plus Spain's continuing debate over the legacy of Franco. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
In Madrid, 7:23 here in London. It is 45 years since the death of the Spanish dictator Franco and the start of the country's journey towards democracy. Yet still, law is being passed dealing with his legacy. The victims of his regime are to be offered reparations as part of a new law that would restrict public support for the former Spanish dictator. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by Pablo Calderón Martínez, who's lecturer in politics and international relations at the New College of the Humanities. Welcome to the program, Pablo.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what are these latest proposals, please?
Well, the law pretty much is building on the law of the historical memory, and is basically a step forward in trying to deal with this, as you said, this legacy of Franco's dictatorship. And the highlights are perhaps that there's still some changes to the Valle de los Caídos, which is where obviously Franco was exhumed from last year, and it's going to become a civil graveyard instead of anything resembling or anything to do with the civil war. So there's not going to be any more links to the Catholic Church, for example. It's going to be a commission that is going to be in charge of any sort of human remains that are still around Spain and dealing with the proper burial of these human remains. But perhaps more controversially, for some, is the banning of organizations that promote the dictatorship, or that have in any way, shape, way or form receive any public funding and in some way elevate the history of the dictatorship. And those type of organizations are going to be banned. And in particular, obviously, they're aiming for the Francisco Franco organization.
Now, this is an interesting point because the head of the Franco Foundation is saying that the government's trying to divert attention from real problems. But we'll come to that in a minute. But how much of a voice do foundations like this still have in Spain?
You'll be surprised. There still has a lot of influence. It has a very important historical archive as well. They're still publishing work. They're still putting things out there. In the last few years, I would say they have somehow tried to moderate the image and they portray this foundation as trying to moderate the debate, something that has become a polarized debate, and they're trying to maintain part of the historical memory as well. So they do play some form of a role. I mean, it has thousands of members and it has had thousands of supporters and people that give money to the foundation. So there are, you know, they're not the most powerful organization, but there's certainly still a wide support for these sort of foundations.
And some have suggested as a result that Spain has been dragging its heels in addressing some of the atrocities of Franco. Is that right?
That is most definitely right, but some would say that it's perhaps now too late. It's been almost half a century. Perhaps this is not the best time to be dealing with these particular issues. This is something that should have been done perhaps maybe, you know, 20, 30 years ago. There's not really a lot of point doing it now. But of course, from my perspective, it's still a welcome development. Way overdue. Definitely too late. But I suppose better late than ever.
What about the future generations of Spain? The way that they are taught about what happened in the all too recent past. The United Nations has noticed that recently Spanish school books still talk about the Civil War in very generic terms, with a kind of telling both sides equally, talking about symmetric responsibility. I mean, how much of this is an issue that Spanish children are still being taught history in that context?
I think personally it's a massive issue. It's a big problem. But it goes just before, it goes beyond primary education, and it goes pretty much, it seeps through all elements of Spanish society, this division and this prism through which you see history and you see pretty much everything. Even politics today are seen through this prism of the Civil War. And you really don't learn properly about the Civil War. And it is seen, history is understood from a political perspective of today. So if you tend to be more conservative or right wing, you're going to see the Civil War as this, you know, unfortunate event in which they had two sides that were equally to blame for what happened. And obviously, if you come from a more left wing persuasion or from a socialist perspective, you're going to see it as a completely different event, as an anti-democratic moment, the destruction of the Second Republic, the destruction of democracy, the implementation of the longest dictatorship in Europe. So, yes, it's a very different way of looking at things, but it's very hard to reconcile these things so late as well. You know, after so many years and after so many, you know, a couple of generations already have been educated in that particular view of the Civil War. And you can see that now reflecting in the polarization of Spanish politics and the polarization of Spanish society in general.
Well, tell us a little bit more finally about Spanish politics and the decision to have this debate and to introduce these laws right now. The socialist leader Pedro Sanchez's government tabled these proposals, and many have said there is the incredibly urgent issue of dealing with the continued coronavirus pandemic. Why now?
Well, I mean, I don't think any politician is beyond playing a little bit of politics, even with these issues, you know, so I'm not, you know, this is a political issue, it's a political decision. So I'm sure it played in the mind of the government to try to distract a little bit, try to move the debate a little bit. But again, that's perfectly understandable and perfectly normal. You know, we could see that happening in the United Kingdom as well, for example. So, you know, it's not necessarily surprising. That doesn't necessarily mean that the law is not necessary and it's not a good development. I don't necessarily agree on the timing. I think the timing could have been better, because even now in Spain, this is not really hitting home and it's not really becoming, you know, part of the debate and the discussion that needs to be had is not being had because obviously everybody's more concerned and more focused in dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, the new lockdowns in Madrid, and this is not really hitting home the way it should be.
Pablo Calderon Martinez, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. In a moment on today's Globalist, we head to St Moritz, where Monocle's High Altitude Summit, The Chief, opens today. But first, with the time at 8.30 in St Moritz, 7.30 here in London, a quick summary of some of the day's other top stories. New Zealand has gone into its deepest recession in decades. It follows measures introduced to cut the spread of COVID-19. GDP shrank by 12.2% between April and June this year. It's the first recession in New Zealand's history since the global financial crisis. The US Democratic candidate Joe Biden has warned against peace in Northern Ireland becoming a casualty of Brexit. Mr. Biden said any UK-US trade deal had to be contingent on respect for the Good Friday Agreement. The British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has been in Washington trying to reassure US politicians about the latest Brexit developments. And the home of the US civil rights figure Rosa Parks has been put on display in Italy. In 1955, Ms. Parks refused to give up her seat on a racially segregated bus in Alabama, marking a key moment in the fight for equal rights. The house she subsequently moved to in Detroit is now in show in the Royal Palace of Naples. And those are the headlines. So let's head now to St Moritz, where Monocle's High Altitude Summit, The Chief, opens today, named after our radio series of the same name. Hosted by Monocle's editors and our sister agency, Wink Creative, a host of CEOs and industry leaders have gathered to talk about how business and how the world moves forward. Well, on the line from St Moritz is our Europe editor-at-large, Ed Stocker. Ed, how's it going where you are?
It's very good. I have to admit that I didn't partake in the early morning swim at 6.50 this morning on a lake near Summer. It's about a 10-minute drive away. I was, of course, preparing for the conference that's taking place.
No, hang on. I'm going to stop you right there. You have to tell us why you didn't go for the swim.
Well, I was too busy preparing, of course. But, you know, I have to come up with intelligent questions in front of panels later today. So I was just doing a little bit of last-minute swatting. But fear not. I think tomorrow morning, before we depart St Moritz, I might try and sneak in a quick swim. But I did hear from a few people who went that the water was pretty frigid this morning. I did go in Zurich, where it was much warmer, but I think tomorrow I'll give it a go.
Right, so we have this, you're setting a typically Swiss scene here, aren't we? We have bathing, plunging into icy, fresh lakes, but we also have the general Swiss paraphernalia as well. There must have been an excellent train ride somewhere.
There was indeed. We had a sort of special carriage on the end of a train. And we sort of curved our way through the mountains. It took about three or four hours from Zurich. It was pretty spectacular. I mean, from my point of view, it's actually my first time. It's been my first time in Zurich and in St Moritz. I've been to French-speaking Switzerland before, but never to this part. So it was pretty memorable. And I think some of our guests who were traveling with us on that train, it was a great chance to sort of mingle and chat before the conference. But, you know, most eyes were also glued on the really breathtaking scenery. I mean, Switzerland is honestly a ridiculously beautiful country. So it was quite an epic journey to sort of get up into the mountains ahead of the conference today.
Right. So tell us about the conference and who we are going to be hearing from.
Well, obviously, you're going to be hearing from all our editors. We've got Tyler here, of course, and Andrew Tuck and Nolan Giles and myself. So we'll be sort of co-hosting throughout the day. But, I mean, we've just got a fantastic roster, really, of people. We've got Peter Maher from the International Committee for the Red Cross, who I'll be speaking to later today with Tyler. Things are actually kicking off in a few minutes, well, in about an hour or so, with Halvi Pulli, who is the head of security policy for Switzerland, a really interesting individual who's originally from Finland. Just talking to her about, you know, the fact that, you know, Switzerland is a neutral country and yet it is making these important decisions about security despite all of that. And there's also a very important vote that's being put to the Swiss people next week, in which it's going to vote on a range of issues, from the free movement of people to whether it will procure new fighter jets for its Air Force. So it'll be interesting to hear her thoughts on that. She'll be joined on stage by Dirk Effenberger from UBS. But we've got people from, you know, we've got brand owners, we've got hotel group owners. There's a whole plethora of people who are, you know, as the title suggests, chiefs, people influencing their different areas throughout the world. And I think, you know, people are just excited to be here, including ourselves. I haven't actually seen all the London team, having been based in New York and now Italy, and with lockdown and everything, it's been 9 months since I've seen all the team. So it's just so nice to, despite the fact that we've had phone calls and obviously emails during that time, to actually be face to face with everyone again. And we had, you know, dinner last night. It's a good feeling. And I think the same goes for both the guests who are speaking and also all the people who are attending. Everyone's just feeling good, obviously still being careful, but everyone's feeling good to be here and be in a room together with lots of fresh mountain air.
Ed Stocker, sounding upbeat in Semeritz, thank you for joining us. We'll have more from the Chiefs Conference today on The Briefing and also on tomorrow's Globalist, so stay tuned. You're with Monocle 24. Let's have a look now at today's papers. Joining me this morning is the urbanist Kat Hannah. Welcome back, Kat.
Good morning, Emma. Good to speak to you again.
Good to have you on the programme. Tell us what you've found in the papers.
So I've got a couple of stories here. As often with me, a bit of focus on some transport and technology. I think I'm beginning probably with a Financial Times long read, which has been looking actually at the impacts of the coronavirus on the global shipping industry, and, you know, actually how kind of surprisingly resilient that industry has been. But an interesting story, I think, given, you know, we often look to the shipping industry, I guess, as quite a visual symbol of globalization. And obviously there's been a lot of conversation about how coronavirus has actually been affecting some of those global relationships and trade as well. So really looking at it through a slightly different lens. We've heard a lot about airplanes, so looking here at a slightly different angle.
So it does say that, I'm quoting here, 6 months after the pandemic brought chaos to the global economy, many of the container lines have navigated this crisis surprisingly well. What do they go on to explain that has happened?
So there's a couple of factors they cite. I think some are relatively unsurprising when we think about it, like the rise of e-commerce means that actually demand did obviously pick up for a lot of the goods that are being transported. But a big factor actually was kind of consolidation and cooperation between some of the major operators as well. That meant that they had fewer fleets sitting idle. They were looking at kind of how to optimize certain routes and essentially really a question of better management. So not necessarily anything particularly kind of sexy and exciting, but really just about the dynamics of how fleets and actually competition between those main operators was managed.
It's astonishing to think that, you know, modern container shipping was around, what, it was the 1950s when everything happened, and it profoundly cut the cost of transporting goods right around the world. I mean, how much does its future now play into the way that we will recover from COVID? Is that something that the FT addresses?
Not in too much detail. There is quite an interesting point they raise about how some of these, you know, the routes actually reflect more about the pattern of globalization and suggesting that it will change. So the line they use is, you know, the pattern of globalization might be changing rather than retreating. And I think that's quite an interesting one, looking at obviously relationships between regions and new trade routes, but also looking actually at the use of kind of smaller vessels as well. So again, reflecting perhaps changes in demand rather than necessarily, you know, the end of some of these, you know, global patterns.
One of the things that it has said is that people who want goods moved, so-called shippers, are having to pay more to have their job done. I mean, how is that going to affect things?
Yeah, and I think that is a factor. I think part of the challenge here could also be, you know, being a seafarer right now is quite difficult. There have been challenges actually in the short term. The article raises about some seafarers being unable to return home. So again, I mean, whether that's going to have a big enough impact on prices, I'm not sure. There have also been factors that mean prices have gone down. So obviously, price of oil, you would imagine, has quite a big role to play. You know, as that has been largely dropping, that has been beneficial to costs as well.
It is an astonishing article, well worth the very, very long read. And the fact that everybody is expecting 2020 to be one of the best years ever for shipping containers, astonishing. Let us move on to a story in The Guardian. A device that captures microplastic particles from tyres as they are emitted has won a big award, a big design award. I mean, we heard a little bit earlier on in the programme about the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen laying out in no uncertain terms that economic recovery must go hand in hand with climate change recovery as well. How much does an invention like this help?
I think it's an important one. And I think with all of these, obviously, there's trade-offs between, you know, changing behaviour as well as looking to kind of innovation and technology to mitigate some of the challenges that we have. I found this quite an interesting article. I think, you know, especially for those of us living in major cities at the moment, it's quite visible that there's been an increase in car use. And obviously, you know, some of the challenges, you know, that will have in terms of emissions. So what this article is actually looking at is one of the challenges that often isn't spoken about and the impacts of emissions from vehicles is actually looking at what are called non-exhaust emissions. So which is basically all the tiny, tiny particles that you get from the kind of consistent wear and tear and braking of brake pads and tyres. So obviously that's what, you know, the team behind this award, they were really focusing on how do we actually reduce the amount of those small particles that are produced. The issue is they're not often kind of counted, like we said, when we think about some of the more obvious, you know, exhaust emissions, and it's often almost more visible, you know, thinking about the threat that they pose. And it's also a problem, actually, you know, if we moved, for example, towards more electric vehicles, obviously they still have tyres, they're often heavier, so they tend to produce more of these particles as well. So it's a really important problem for these young people to be solving. And I think what was quite interesting to me about this approach as well, and they have a quote actually, you know, from a team member, actually citing the importance of the diversity of the team, you know, coming from, you know, different places around the world, but actually having a range of skills between engineering, architecture, biomechanics. So I think really quite an important lesson to be learned there about the role of collaboration as well.
Let's move on to a story from The Telegraph. Singapore will pay citizens to use Apple Watches.
Yes. So I think I guess those who follow technology will know the sixth Apple Watch launched earlier this week. And as the article highlights, you know, it's very much kind of put health and fitness and all the various applications that the watch could have at the kind of front and centre of that launch. So this article is here actually looking at a partnership that's going to be happening in Singapore, where essentially the government will be giving rewards to those who are using the watch in terms of boosting their physical activity. So if you reach a certain goal or a certain challenge, maybe it could be walking distances, then receiving kind of rewards and vouchers, you know, as an incentive really to get more active.
How much does it depend on citizens being of the obedient type to want to engage in this?
Yeah, and I think this is an interesting question. There's potentially, do you get those who are more kind of self-selecting who would put themselves forward? But again, as the article highlights, you know, Singapore, you know, was one of the first countries to actually use a kind of contract tracing app in order to help reduce the spread of the virus. So, you know, you could potentially point towards there being a sense of being perhaps a bit more, you know, willing to trade off potential some of the privacy aspects, privacy and security around data, which, you know, Apple have been, you know, obviously very keen to point out the importance of that. But to trade that off in terms of getting broader kind of health and societal benefits.
And it also introduces the idea of Apple, obviously a private company, engaging with the authorities in a way which is, in collaboration with the authorities, or working with the authorities, I should say.
Yes, I mean, I think the word I think both parties would seek to use here is a partnership. But what actually is quite interesting is, you know, it was a proposal that apparently began kind of from the Singapore government, who are actually looking for proposals from companies about how to improve population health. So it'd be interesting to know, obviously, you know, who else was in the running. But I think, again, you know, an interesting example here of, I guess it's, you know, it's kind of taking what you often talk about, you know, nudging certain types of behavioral change. And I guess this is, you know, one example of taking that to the next level and personalizing it through use of technology.
Indeed. I mean, is this something that you would actually consider in your work? I mean, you're an urbanist, a master planner. To what degree are we now moving towards the local authorities' involvement in people's private health?
It's a really interesting question. And I think, you know, it's probably something we are, I would say, probably a bit less comfortable here with. I think we're obviously seeing right now the importance of actually getting the basics right when it comes to, you know, the role that the government has in health. I mean, I think from my perspective, it's really just about getting the basic infrastructure right that gives people the choice. So, you know, we've seen with local authorities, obviously, you know, reconfiguring roads very quickly to in order the space for social distancing so people can walk more, road closures, you know, to enable, you know, more cycling and physical activity, especially kind of during the height of lockdown. So I think it's actually creating the right environment, you know, physically that actually makes that active behaviour, you know, really appealing is, I think, probably a really important first step. Whether it's, you know, more important than getting a little buzz on a device on your wrist telling you it's time to get up from your desk and go for a walk is another question. But I think really from the place perspective is having that environment in which to do it, where it's actually fun and appealing as well, is really important.
Kat Hannah, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Welcome back. It's time now to check in with Akshat Rathi, who's Bloomberg News climate and energy reporter. Welcome back to the programme, Akshat. Good to have you.
Good morning.
We've mentioned several times in this programme already the urgency of the problems in California and Oregon with wildfires. You have closer figures now in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide and pollution that is being released as a result of this.
Yes, Europe's Copernicus satellite monitoring service has found that the emissions from all Western fires in the US will put out about 200 million tons of carbon dioxide, which is a lot and it's a record amount. But just to put it in context, the US puts out about 4,400 million tons in fossil fuel emissions. So it's still a small number in comparison to what humans are already doing to the planet. And that's not the only problem. Carbon dioxide emissions, of course, heat up the planet. There is an immediate and short-term problem, which is air pollution, particulate matter. And we've all probably seen colors of the sky in the western coast, orange to red. Well, some of that pollution is now going to come all the way to northern Europe later this week.
And the consequences of this are what? I mean, once you have put the fires out, pollution and climate change suddenly becomes front and centre of any campaign for the White House.
Yes, and you can see that happening already with both Donald Trump and Joe Biden having to have talk about the fires this week. And we saw very clearly that Trump denied the science, whereas Biden is pushing very hard to make climate a big talking point in the debates coming.
How much do you think that it will become a talking point? It places it front and centre. We can imagine Joe Biden going quite hard on that. But, I mean, what do we think of the reaction that Donald Trump is or perhaps will not have? I mean, he's been to California, but one trip doesn't solve a policy.
No, and I don't think that he has an agenda on climate change anyway. We know that from the the document that the Republican Party has put out, which is just a one-pager saying we're just going to follow through on the commitments we'd made 4 years ago. And Donald Trump's policy plan on climate change is essentially rolling back regulations and helping the fossil fuel industry. Whereas on Joe Biden's side, he's been getting a lot of push to be further left on climate change, to be much more ambitious in cutting emissions. And I think we're just going to see that divergence play out more strongly.
Let's move on to another story in terms of cars and pollution. Tell us what's happening there.
So we know for a while that China is one of the leading electric car manufacturers, and it's got into that position because it has a vast battery manufacturing capacity, which has allowed it to lower the price of batteries and make its electric cars much cheaper. What's more surprising, though, is that even though we hear of Tesla, the US is falling behind and has fallen behind even Europe in terms of battery manufacturing. And that may seem like a small thing today, but in 5 to 10 years' time, when electric cars are really mainstream, it's becoming clear that the US is falling back, and that's going to have very severe consequences for the country.
I mean, the Americans were the great drivers of the internal combustion engine, as were the Germans. I mean, are we looking at a situation, Akshat, where America plays a very secondary role in the future of transport? That almost seems unthinkable, doesn't it?
It does, and technology is a weird one to predict when there's such a lot of transition happening, both in terms of energy sources, but also in terms of burgeoning economies in Asia. But if we just look at batteries, it is becoming clear that Asia is threatening to be the dominant force in the rest of the century.
Akshat, let's move on to a message sent to the British government to play a bigger role in tackling climate change. This is sort of being called out. They're calling out the government, aren't they?
Yes. I wanted to share this as an idea worth spreading. So the British government, through the parliamentary committee, put together what they call a citizens' assembly on climate change. This was a six-month process. It was supposed to happen in person, started out as such, and then, of course, the pandemic hit. It became a virtual one. About a group of 110 Brits from all backgrounds and all different faiths and gender were selected to discuss how the UK can reach net zero and what are the policies they would choose to adopt if that is the goal that they have to reach. And to me, it's just a remarkable and a worth celebrating exercise in democracy where really highly informed people come and tell the average person what it is that we are going to have to do in the next 3 decades to really tackle this problem.
Akshat Rathi, as ever, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist. Finally today, the CEO of British Airways has told British MPs that the airline is fighting for its survival. Alex Cruz warned BA may never be the same again after the coronavirus pandemic, and he said the industry faced permanent structural change from the worst crisis in aviation history. Well, for more, I'm joined by Gabriel Lee, Monocle's transport correspondent. Welcome, Gabriel.
Thank you.
Good morning to you. Right, this was a stark warning. It made for very uncomfortable watching. And Mr. Cruz did not hold back, did he?
No. I mean, you know, I think you have been seeing similar warnings from airline bosses
over the past few months, and we can expect to see many more now, because we're exiting the sort of summer season that was supposed to mark a kind of beginning of recovery. For many airlines, it didn't go as they had hoped, and the sort of global climate for movement of people just isn't there, in part because, you know, there are so many borders still locked down, so many quarantine requirements, that kind of thing. So, you know, the other thing to know about this sort of thing is that you should always wonder, well, why are they saying this now? What are they trying to get, right? And of course, Bierre trying to push for politicians to sort of help them out in various ways. But surely it is not good news. No, not at all.
It's not. I mean, his warning was huge, and it's not often, when you think about British Airways and its communication strategy, it is generally one of sort of brittle refusal to engage with problems. It's improved in the last few years, but it hasn't done British Airways' reputation any great favours. And yet here we have Alex Cruz being incredibly open about how bad the situation is. I mean, what exactly is he trying to say here?
I mean, I think he's hoping to sort of wake up both the sort of public perception around, you know, the BA has had a number of sort of PR hits as well this past few months with, you know, the whole thing of trying to fire all of its staff more or less and then rehire them on inferior contracts, that kind of thing. So that they're trying to sort of build back the sort of public sympathy, I would say, but also to get politicians in the UK in this case, and also worldwide, to kind of listen up and understand that now that we're going into this period where there's, you know, less demand, there's almost no business travel, governments need to get behind figuring out some ways so that people can move again. You know, he advocated for testing. This is a big thing that so far has pretty much fallen on deaf ears in the UK and elsewhere, too, that airlines would like to see testing regimes so that they can bring in people without 14-day quarantines. But for the most part, governments are not hopping on board this, at least not in the major European nations.
Why aren't they deciding to do this?
That's a very good question. I mean, you could look at a number of factors, I think. I think you do see this kind of reaction to the virus that's very kind of isolationist, that's very nativist, that's very, you know, let's batten down the hatches and work this out and not let any foreigners in, which, you know, a lot of research shows is misguided. Of course, foreigners can come into England, but, you know, for example, in England, you have to do a 14-day quarantine. So very few business travelers are going to do that. Very few tourists are going to do that. You know, there is research that suggests there's a better way, that, you know, a testing regime, it will not stop every incidence of the virus, will not stop all infections, but can get pretty close and can sort of get back to some kind of a semblance of normalcy. And airlines, there may be many people who wish to travel at this point, whether for business or for leisure, to see their friends or family. But airlines, they're not going to be able to find a public that will buy tickets at this point with all the uncertainty. Cruz also mentioned the situation with England changing its list of quarantine countries every week. I mean, who's going to book a holiday with that going on, let alone an important business meeting or get together?
Tell us a little bit about other airlines' reactions. I mean, Alex Cruz, obviously put on the spot because he was facing a committee of parliamentarians. But other airlines, have they adopted an equally sort of scorched earth approach in terms of their reaction to what's happened? Or is there another way of doing this?
You're hearing a lot of grave warnings from a lot of airlines. If you go across the Atlantic, you see that, you know, some of this airline assistance packages are going to stop at the end of this month. And airlines are definitely being vocal about the fact that that will mean that they are going to furlough thousands of workers. They're going to cut destinations. There'll be cities that don't have air service anymore, potentially. This is usually the big flag carriers, the big international airlines, which are the hardest hit. Some of the more domestic oriented airlines, say in the US, they're a bit better off. But anyway, and you have it in Europe too, of course, although I think other airlines in Europe have everybody's losing money, basically. Everybody's doing poorly. But at least it seems that, you know, in a place like Germany, they are sort of taking constructive approaches to, you know, how can we establish a testing center? How can we take countries off the quarantine list and keep them off? It's not going perfectly anywhere, but I think that, you know, an airline like Lufthansa would see that, you know, that it has a little bit more buy-in from the government and sort of trying to work out a way that this can work for airlines. And of course, they got a bunch of money as well, you know, as did Air France, as did KLM. You know, it's a mixed bag, but I would say we're going to be seeing more and more stark warnings from airlines in the coming weeks, because this is a time when the demand is just dropping off and much worse than previously expected.
Gabriel Lee, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Daniel Bate, Carlotta Ribello and Augustin Macellari, our researcher, Charlie Phil McCourt, and our studio manager, Nora Hoyle. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing's live at midday in London. Hope you can join me for that if you can. And The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.